Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Clones, what's cracking? Welcome to the Daily Jungle. The karma is still rolling. The Caps take a bat to the Penguins. Markelle Fultz, the NBA's potential number one overall pick, joined the show. Matt Carpenter of the St. Louis Cardinals came in. We had a great conversation, as always. And Nashville Predators head coach Peter Laviolette joined us. The Preds still lying out and waiting for their opponent in the Western Conference Finals. Lots to get to. Alvy, go ahead and start it. When are you going to learn to trust me? And even more importantly, when are you going to learn not to disrespect me? When it comes to my Stanley Cup predictions. Because when I put myself out there and I picked the Washington Capitals to win it all, the same Capitals that have found a way to underachieve and melt down routinely in the postseason, you all thought that I was out of my mind. And then, when a young Toronto Maple Leaf squad pushed them hard in the first round, you couldn't wait to jump me, talk junk about my pick, and pile on. Except the Caps came back to win that series. As I knew they would, as I said they would. And although I know that many of you hit your knees every single night and pray that my pick will blow up in my grill so you can bum rush me again and throw it in my face, I don't take offense. In fact, I accept your apology. Except you started up again in the second round. When Pittsburgh jumped on the Caps 3-1, and they had three chances to finish. And I said I wasn't worried when they were down 3-1, that I'd never been wrong before with my Stanley Cup prediction, and I was not about to start right now. And what happens? They dig deep. They win game five. They send it back to Pittsburgh. Then what? Then you crack me all over again, saying nothing hurt. The Penguins are going back home, and there's no way the Caps, the choking Caps, come out of that barn with a win. No way they beat Pittsburgh in their house. And then I'm thinking, where the hell did all these Penguin fans come from? There's like millions of Penguin fans. Where are they all coming from? Do they just not say Jack during the regular season? Or are they all bandwagoners and frontrunners? Neither. You're not here to love the Penguins. You're here to hate on my pick. You don't want the Penguins to win. You want the Capitals to lose because you want me to look bad. Again, no harm, no foul. I get it. It probably would be awesome to see me miss on my pick and have one of sport's all-time greatest streaks come to an end because all great things do come to an end. That probably would make you feel better about you. All good. All good, except for one thing. The Caps went into Pittsburgh, and they caved in the Penguins' faces last night. They punched a hole in the chest of Marc-Andre Fleury. They knocked Sid Crosby around the rink, and they treated the defending Stanley Cup champs like a speed bag.
Backstrom looking to get it off the right wing wall. Feeding it in front. They score! T.J. Oshie! Angie turning it over. The Capitals bringing it low here and going short side of shot. They score! Andre Burakovsky!
The Capitals begin here with Backstrom and a shot.
He scores! Nicklas Backstrom with a rocket!
20 seconds to go.
J. Beagle, all right. It's Carlson, a shot! He scores!
The defending champ suddenly are on the ropes. The puck now to Burakovsky. He moves in, waits, and scores! And we'll see you on Wednesday night. It's 5-0 Washington!
Caps Radio never sounded so awesome! 5 goals, each one piercing the invincibility shield that Fleury had been wearing all series long. Each one another bat to the head of a Penguins team that looked like they were ready to choke out the Caps earlier this series. But what did I tell you about this Caps team? Not the same old choking dogs. Not the President's Trophy winners that waved that white flag in round two. And now, after ripping away a W in Pittsburgh, something that rarely happens even in the regular season, much less an elimination game in the postseason, this series does shift back to the district, where Washington was the best home team in the NHL this season. This is what I keep telling you. It's a gift I have. That's why I told you. I'm not worried. Trotsky and the boys got this. T.J. Oshie, Jungle, freaking Karma, lighting the lamp to get it started. That depth that I talked about, all their stars finally showing up when they have to, like stars. And then the Caps, staring at the brink of disaster, yet again, shrug it off like it's nothing at all, because that's what champions do. That's why it's a best of seven. That's why it's first to four. And that's why it's the Stanley Cup. It's not supposed to be easy. It's supposed to be a war. It's supposed to test your resolve and force you to overcome adversity and to do it over and over and over again. And while the Caps are getting stronger and more confident, the Penguins are leaking oil and engine parts. And now they're looking for a place to just lie down and die, not having Chris Letang. And Trevor Daley is catching up to them now. And sooner or later, those clanged pipes were going to turn into goals. Sooner or later, the magic was going to wear off on Fleury, who finally fell back to earth last night. Yeah, I know. We get it, Rome. We get it. No, you don't. I would not be spending all this time on it if you got it. I could do this for 3 hours. So here's what you do. Push them all to the middle Wednesday night in the district, back from the dead, and ready to drive that final stake right through the defending champs in an epic Game 7. C-A-P-S, Caps, Caps, Caps. Oh, and sure. Oh, yeah, I know this. Coming all the way back and staving off elimination in back-to-back games to get it back to Game 7, only to go right into the tank and get punked on their home ice would be the most Caps thing ever. Ever. But that's not going to happen. Not now, not there, not on my watch, and not after I picked them all to win it. Because I knew this would happen, and I knew they'd battle up and force that Game 7. Because these Caps are different. And I wouldn't have picked them, and I wouldn't be riding with them if they weren't. See you Wednesday.
Karma.
Markelle Fultz is my guest. You're close now. The NBA Draft Combine starts later on this week. So what are your thoughts heading into the Combine, and what are you looking to accomplish once you get there?
Really, I don't think I'll be doing anything. I'm just going to be meeting with people, just showing them what I have to offer on and off the court. To show them a humble young man and the person I am.
We're talking to Markelle Fultz. All right, so you're in position right now to be the number one pick in the draft. And a lot of guys would say that it doesn't really matter where they go in the draft as long as they get drafted. But when you've been putting in the work you've been putting in, how important is it to you then to go number one?
I mean, it's pretty big to me. I mean, just from all the work I've done since I've been a little kid to now, it's always been my dream to be the number one pick. So that's what I want to go. So I hope everything works out.
Markelle Fultz joining us. You mentioned since you were a little kid, your mom talks about how you were kind of a throwback because when you were growing up, you'd get up early, you'd go outside, you'd spend the entire day outside, and that back in the day, you were a big BMX rider and a bit of a daredevil. So, like, what kind of stuff were you doing on the bike back then?
Wheelies, jumping off ramps. I mean, pretty much anything you can imagine. Just trying to do the stuff I've seen on TV and just doing stuff that people dare me to do. So, I mean, it was fun. I mean, I had fun doing it, but unfortunately, I can't do it right now.
No, that's out. You can't do that right now, but you're into other stuff, too. For instance, you're into karate. So when did you first fall in love with basketball, and what was it about the game that got you hooked?
I've been playing basketball since I was three, but, I mean, I think just how much fun I had playing the game. I mean, I felt like that was the most happiest point of my life was when I was on the court or if I had a ball in my hand. So, I mean, ever since I was a baby, pretty much, I would say I fell in love with the game, and It's just how much fun I have playing it that makes it so fun.
Now, it's not a case where you've always been number one, not your entire life. For instance, you went to DeMatha, and you were cut from the varsity team as a sophomore, and you played JV instead. So what did that feel like when you were cut, and then how did you respond to that?
I mean, when I was cut, I mean, at first I was very upset, but at the end of the day, my mom always told me everything happened for a reason. So when I walked out the office and I went to the car, all I thought was about going to the gym and working, and my mom just told me, like she said, everything happens for a reason. Just believe in God and work harder. And so I went to the gym that day and started working.
Markelle Fultz getting ready for the NBA draft. You know, guys in the NBA are already aware of you. One player told SI, quote, people don't realize, they don't realize it because they don't get to watch him so much, but I don't want to say he's Russ level, but he's closer to that than not. If he went to the combine, which I'm not sure he'd ever have a reason to, but if he went, he would test off the charts. He's just a bleeping freak, end quote. That's an anonymous NBA player. So what's your reaction when you hear an NBA player say that you're close to Russell Westbrook level athlete?
I mean, I think that's unbelievable, really. It just shows all the hard work I put in, and that is starting to show worldwide. And I think that people that really know basketball and watch basketball see what I have in me, and it's just motivating me to work harder.
Clones, I have got to talk to you right now about Stamps.
Stamps.com.
Listen, Stamps saves you time and money, which you can use to grow your business. I can mail any letter, any package, using just my computer and printer, and the mailman will pick it up. I can avoid the hassle of the post office and mail everything from postcards to envelopes to packages, domestic or international. I use Stamps.com because I love how easy it is. I love how convenient it is. I hate going to the post office. I no longer have to. And right now, you too can enjoy the Stamps service with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus postage and digital scale without long-term commitments. Go to Stamps.com. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage. Type in Rome. Stamps.com. Enter Rome. Stamps.com. Never, ever go to the post office again. That's Stamps.com. Now it's back to our Daily Jungle. All right, before you go, and you mentioned people who really know basketball. Before you go, Lonzo Ball and his family have been getting a lot of hype over the past couple of months. You know this. You see this. You're keeping a low profile, however, and you're just going about your work. You're keeping your head down. He said that he thinks he's a better player than you and that he leads a team better than you. What's your reaction when you hear that? Does it make you mad, or is it something you just kind of laugh off and ignore?
I mean, it's something that I laugh at, but it's also something that motivates me even more just to prove everybody wrong. I mean, obviously, he's a great competitor and he's supposed to think that, but it just makes me go back in the gym and work even harder.
You know, you're a great competitor. You might think that, but is that something you would say?
Something I would say?
Right. I mean, he said it.
Yeah, of course. Me, I would say, I mean, I think I'm a good playmaker. I make my team better and everything like that. So, yes, I would say that.
All right. So now you've said that making your mom happy means the world to you, that basketball eventually is going to end for you and you still want to make your mom happy. We're now just 6 weeks away from the draft. What's it going to mean to you to hear your name called and know that you can take care of your mom forever?
Oh, man, that's going to be the biggest moment of my life, really. That's when everything's going to change for me and my family. I really just want to make sure my mom is getting paid back for everything she's done. That's still not going to be enough, but I know that she won't have to stress anymore and she won't have to do anything that she's used to been doing.
The Mets hope that they get Matt Harvey back on the mound Friday in Milwaukee after he served a 3-game suspension for that no-show over the weekend. And while everybody inside the Mets organization wants to move on, more and more details are coming out about when he went AWOL on Saturday. And look, I'm no doctor, but that migraine headache may have been self-induced. That's the thing about migraine headaches. We don't know where they come from. If we did, people wouldn't get them, but we don't know. However, his may have been self-induced. I mean, what is that, Matt? What is that? I mean, really? Page Six reports that the night before Harvey no-showed at the ballpark, he was out getting loose on Cinco de Mayo, going Cinco de Drinko at a popular nightclub, One Oak, rolling up at around 1 o'clock in the morning with his boys and staying until 4 o'clock, after a night of Don Julio Tequila, Belvedere Vodka, and Ace of Spades Champagne. So that migraine headache that he says he had might have been nothing more than a hangover to the rest of us. And the rest of us would have hit it with some ibuprofen and then just chased it with huevos rancheros or a greasy burger. And then we'd go about our business. But we'd take care of our business. Harvey, on the other hand, apparently chased it with a tea time and a no-show at work. And why? Because he had a migraine. Because he had a migraine. Yeah, if that's a migraine, I'm terrific Tom Seaver. If that's a migraine, then for about 10 years of my life, before I had kids and baseball games and everything else, I suffered a migraine 2 nights a week, 52 weekends a year. And that migraine came an ounce or two at a time out of a bottle called Magic Blue. I mean, that's what makes this story so predictable. How many times do we have to do this? When will athletes get the memo? Get drunk, sleep through a team meeting, say you're sorry, wear it, and then the story goes away. Just another blip on a Mets radar. But the trouble comes inevitably with the cover-up, because the cover-up is always worse than the crime. So when you say you're going to file a grievance, when you say you had a legit migraine, maybe you make sure that the night before, you're not seen rolling deep with your boys on Cinco de Drinko, because Page Six is not going to swing and miss at your BP cheddar. The New York tabloids are not going to miss you rolling up to one of the most popular clubs in town on a Friday night. An absolute amateur hour for drinkers. And this isn't year one in New York for Harvey. And this is not mistake one either for Harvey. Problem is, while this guy still doesn't get it, and the fact that he doesn't get it yet probably means he never will, the Mets still need him. That's why manager Terry Collins is doing everything he can to get everybody to just turn the page and bring this guy back into the fold.
He made a mistake the other day. I think we'll get by it. I think we'll get through it. He's just a big guy. He's a big figure on our club. He's a big figure in New York. And that's a big city to be a big figure in.
He's a big guy. He's a big figure. He's a big lush. He made a mistake. Hey, look, the manager might be willing to forgive and forget, but I'm not sure his teammates are. Not unless the guy owns it. Not unless the guy wears it. And not unless the guy apologizes for it. Something he clearly is not doing if he's filing a grievance. That means he doesn't think that he did anything wrong. That means he thinks he's been falsely accused. Something that obviously aggravates a good portion of that clubhouse. Listen to some of these quotes from guys who were given the chance to speak anonymously. One guy said, quote, "He wants to be Derek Jeter. To do that, you've got to show up." These quotes were given anonymously to Newsday, New York Newsday. "He wants to be Derek Jeter. To do that, you've got to show up." Quote, "Something had to happen. There had to be a sense of accountability." Quote, "You could see all of this coming." So, Harv, maybe you put that "Saturday is for the Hamptons" tee back in the drawer. Maybe you spend a little less time working on the short game and a little more time getting that fastball back in the high 90s. You see, fat, lazy, and selfish may work sometimes when you're throwing gas and you're mowing down opponents and you take the ball every 5 days. But it never works when you're getting knocked around with an ERA of over 5 and you're chasing a bender on Cinco de Drinco with an early morning tea time and a power nap. Then you get what you deserve, a 3-gamer without pay. So for the sake of the Mets and for what's left of your career, do what you should have done from the very start. Just own it, because you're not fooling anybody, not the fans, not your teammates, and certainly not the opposing batters. And even not your own manager.
When he comes tomorrow, we'll have a discussion. And one thing he has to do is, again, he's done it in the past. He needs to address some guys, and he wants to do it in a group, which is the easiest, I always think. Or if he wants to do it individually, he can do that.
So while this guy is filing a grievance, presumably because he thinks he did nothing wrong, his own manager is saying this guy better make it right in the clubhouse. He better come around here and, quote, address some guys. Do it individually, do it in a group, but address some guys. In other words, come correct, own it, apologize for it, and hope they forgive you. I love the part about he's done it in the past. He's done it in the past. How many times do you have to address your teammates as a group over something you've said or done? If you have to do it more than once, there's a problem. And he's saying he's done it in the past. And can I ask another question? Exactly what do you have to do to disappoint the Mets? How far out of line do you have to be to disappoint the Mets? To apologize to the Mets? And it's not the first time. Down goes Harvey. And that migraine sure looks a hell of a lot like a hangover. So you can add his name to the list. Another victim of Cinco de Drinco.
That's pretty lame.
We are joined by Matt Carpenter. Matt, nice to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing good, Jim, man. Thanks for having me on.
Matt, always good to talk to you. Thanks so much for doing it. Now, you beat the Marlins last night. Matt, you win your 4 straight, your 7th straight road game, and you've outscored teams 30-11 in the last 4 games. You're currently in first in the NL Central. What I'm saying is things are rolling. What's it like to be a Cardinal right about now?
Man, you know, things are starting to come together for us. We got off to a semi-slow start. I think we started 3-9. But, you know, things are getting together. Pitching's been great. Defense is starting to come along, and our bats are starting to heat up a little bit. And that's been the difference. And, you know, as we all know, it's fun to be on a little roll and to get on a little streak, and that's what we got going on right now.
That's fun, and we also all know how long the year can be. You mentioned, Matthew, you were 3-9. And at that time, there was a sense outside the clubhouse that great run that this team has been on for the last number of years might finally be coming to an end. But what was the mood like on the inside of the clubhouse at that time?
You know, one thing that we do a great job here in St. Louis is we never push that panic button through times of trial, through adversity. And this was no different. I mean, things were ugly. I'm going to call it like it was. I mean, it was ugly. We weren't playing well. We were playing sloppy. You know, things just weren't clicking. But at the end of the day, we never lost confidence in the group that we had out there every day. And we've been able to turn that around. Part of that is through the leadership that we got, guys like Yadier Molina, Adam Wainwright, myself, just keeping these young guys ready, focused every day, ready to go out there and try to give us our best game.
And since then, you've gone 14-5, so certainly it did turn around. Also, over that stretch, Matt, the starting pitchers are 12-1. They've got an ERA of barely over 3. So as a hitter, what's it like to go to the ballpark every single day knowing that if you put a few runs on the board, you've got a real good chance of winning?
Oh, man, it's great. You know, I mean, baseball is a game that's literally dictated by your starting pitching. And when you go through a stretch, when they're going out and they're dominating, the wins really can rack up. And it's like that on both sides of the game. I mean, from an offensive standpoint, when you're facing a tough starting pitcher, it's hard to score. So they're on a nice run right now, and we're going to try to ride that out as long as we can.
Matt Carpenter joining us once again. Now, last night's win was thanks in part to Carlos Martinez throwing 6 strong innings on the mound. He also went 2-for-3 at the plate. He had 4 runs batted in. What did you make of the way he handled the bat yesterday?
Oh, man. You know what? I'll be honest. It's the first time I've seen him swing the bat like he did. We've got some offensive threats from a pitcher standpoint on our team. Mike Leake swings the bat really well. Adam Wainwright is a potential silver slugger candidate. We haven't seen that much out of Carlos, but last night was a stretch in the right direction. He looked really good. Got some good pitches to hit, drove in some key runs for us. And if he didn't show up yesterday, we'd probably still be playing. I think it'd be 4-4 instead of 9-4. I think he had 5 RBIs, something like that. So it was a good day for him.
It's contagious. Swinging the bat's contagious. You mentioned Adam Wainwright. Waino, very proud of his hitting. It comes up as a topic on this show every single time he's on. You're a silver slugger. You said that he might one day be a silver slugger. So break it down. Is Wainwright a good hitter for a pitcher, or is he just a good hitter, period?
I think he's a good hitter, period. I mean, the guy's just a good athlete. He's a scratch golfer. Can shoot a basketball, can play ping pong. He's just one of those guys that does it all. He's 6'7", got that tall, lanky, athletic frame. He stands in the box. He's got a good swing. He's got a good short stroke, powerful stroke. There's pop in his bat. I mean, he's a tough out. Do I think he's going to be could he be an everyday major league hitter? I don't know. That's tough to do, but there's no doubt he's in the upper echelons for hitters as starting pitchers.
We're talking to Matt Carpenter. You know, Matt, when you were 3-9, you talked about how important it was to have leadership and the patience in the clubhouse. Patience is nothing new to you. You've got one of the highest OPSs in baseball in the past decade as a leadoff hitter, and now you're batting 3rd in the lineup and you're 2nd in the league in walks. When you were coming up in college in the minors, did coaches love the fact that you would take pitches, or was some of them bothered by that, and did they want you to swing the bat and be more aggressive?
You know, it was hit or miss. Some of the coaches that I played for in my career, they saw the value in my strike zone discipline and the ability to take pitches. But there were certainly coaches along the way that at times would get on me about, man, we got to have you swing the bat, be more aggressive, put the ball in play, this sort of stuff. My college coach was one guy that really, at the beginning of my career, was annoyed by the amount of pitches that I took. And then as I got into pro ball, I ran into coaches that were the same way. But, looking back, all those coaches, we've communicated as time has gone on, stayed in touch with them. They've all realized that was what makes me the hitter that I am. I mean, it's my biggest strength as a hitter, as I go to the plate, the ability to work a walk, the ability to work a count and get good pitches. And, it's worked for me. And it's something that I've never steered away from as much as sometimes it can bother coaches, and they do want to see me pull the trigger a little more often.
Hey, Matt, it's one thing when you're in the majors and you're 10 years in plus and you've had success and you've got a philosophy and you're going to stick with it, and maybe a hitting coach or a manager will try and tell you something, but you've got conviction because you've done it for so long. But when you're a young player and you're playing college ball and you're on scholarship and a coach is saying to you, hey, look, you got to swing the bat, you got to pull the trigger, it's kind of tough to stick to your conviction, isn't it? Like, what were you thinking when you were a young player and a college coach was telling you should do it this way?
There were times where it did get to me, but it's something that's so ingrained in me. It's just who I am. It's hard for me to not be that guy. And a lot of times it just happened. I wasn't doing it out of spite, like where, I know you want me to swing, but I'm just going to do this anyway because this is what I want to do. It was more of what I had to do. I mean, I just, you know, I have a conversation. This is a funny conversation I have with Yadier Molina. You know, we're the complete opposite as far as hitters. You know, he's the kind of guy that is ready to swing as soon as he steps in the box, and I'm the kind of guy that kind of waits around, waits for his pitch. And he told me that when he wants to take a pitch, he literally has to take the bat off of his shoulders, like hold it in a position where he won't swing, because if he's in a stance and it's somewhere close, even though he's told himself, I'm going to take this, if it's close, he'll swing. Well, I'm the exact opposite, where, like, I have to tell myself, like, okay, you have to swing here. You've got to swing. And then it's right there. I'm like, oh, man, I couldn't do it. You know, and then I think that's just some kind of way that my brain is wired. I mean, like, in college, hit and runs was, like, the hardest play for me. It's like having to swing at this pitch, like, whether – no matter where it is. It's just always been a challenge for me. So, it's just who I am.
You took the words right out of my mouth. I was going to say you're wired for it. You're probably wired for it. If you can't change – and it's hard for you to actually pull the trigger when you're not ready to do so or you don't want to. You're probably wired for it like he's wired the other way. Now, you're playing primarily first base this year after playing a mix of first, second, and third last year. Every time the team asks you to move, you do it, and you do it well. Do you like that challenge, or is there a part of you that would like to say, guys, I am a three-time All-Star. You don't need to be moving me around all the time.
You know, I love it. I really do like the challenge. I love just being a baseball player. I mean, I grew up around the game. My dad's a high school baseball coach. I spent, you know, countless hours around the baseball field. And I take a lot of pride in the fact that I can be that option for our team, that our manager can have the ability to put me in different spots, both in the lineup, but both at the position and in the batting order. And I want to be the guy that, you know, we'll do whatever it takes for our team to win a game. If they need me at third for that day, that gives us the best chance to win, I'm ready to go over there. If they need me at second, then I'll do that as well. And, you know, it's just a philosophy that I've had my whole career. And, you know, there's no ego with it. I really enjoy moving around. And I've made that clear to both Mike, our manager, and our front office. And they've taken full advantage of it.
You know, watching you play all this time and talking to you and listening to you, it sounds like this is not surprising at all. Like, this was inevitable. You were going to end up in this place. But then you remember, we've talked about your journey in the past, the fact that you blew out your elbow in college, that you were a 13th round pick out of TCU. You were offered a $1,000 signing bonus, yet here you are, a key piece of the organization, somebody that team is built around. So when you look back at some of the tough times that you had in college, did you ever wonder if maybe you'd get to this spot, or did you always know that this was part of the plan and it was going to work out?
I always knew baseball was going to be something involved. I was going to be involved in it in some fashion, whether it was coaching or playing. I knew that it was something. I knew the love for the game was something that I couldn't just walk away from. There were certainly times in college when I was going through my rough spells that we talked about where I was the farthest thing from a major league prospect, that I would be lying if I didn't think that I probably wasn't going to make it. But there was also that small glimmer of hope, that kind of burning desire to keep playing because I loved it so much. So that when I finally started putting it all together from a health standpoint and a workout standpoint, you know, the pages kind of started to fill in, and I was able to reach that goal. And then once I got that opportunity, man, I hit the ground running. I never gave up on it. And I've just continued to try to build on that momentum that started back in the minor leagues, and it's been a fun journey.
Emails.
Dear Romy, we're going to need a bigger boat.
You're
going to
need a bigger boat.
Signed, Jim. Not Jim McElwain. Blake in Beemore. Well, I was going to do Dwight Howard, but as long as you're continuing to email and tweet about that. And like I said, nothing worse than when what you do in your private becomes public. Like when a photo of yourself falls into the wrong hands. And by the wrong hands, I mean everybody on the internet. Weird story. Over the weekend, a photo goes viral of a, I don't know how to put this, like a grinning, plump, naked guy hugging on what appears to be a dead shark on the back of a boat. UK-based wildlife TV personality Annika Svenska took great offense to the photo, and she tweeted it asking, "Who is this man? Please retweet. Find him and ask him why he did this. Where is the humor in humiliating slaughtered animals?" Fair point. Fair question. And when you put the internet up to a task like that, the internet moves fast and it moves diligently. Only with this photo, it took maybe 2 seconds to realize that the naked dude riding that shark looked exactly like Florida Gators head football coach Jim McElwain. So that pic circulates message boards and SEC Twitter all weekend long. I mean, no doubt, that grin, that hair, that body type. I mean, that was Jim McElwain, right? It looked like McElwain. Deadspin jumps on it, reaches out to Florida, and a spokesman for the school's athletic department said that McElwain became aware of the photo over the weekend, and then the spokesperson added, quote, "He's told us it's not him." That's an interesting denial. He's told us it's not him. Because that's not a flat-out denial. Not a flat-out denial by the school. Not unequivocally, absolutely, that is not him. No, just he told us it's not him. Oh, really? You mean he didn't openly admit to humping Jaws? How would that conversation go? Hey, Jim. Coach? That's not you humping that shark naked in that photo, is it? No? Oh, okay, cool. Wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't ask, coach. I mean, what do you think the guy's going to say? If your boss hit you up asking if you got naked with a dead shark this weekend, would you own it? Hell no. So, of course, he's not looking to own it. Look, let's be real clear about this. I'm not saying it is him. I'm just saying that Florida's defense could have been a little bit stronger. Could have been a little more persuasive. I mean, notice there wasn't any alibi. Like, oh no, that's not Coach. He's got an alibi. No, Jim was out recruiting this weekend. No, Coach was watching film. Yeah, maybe because he was creating his own film. Sharknado porn. Shark porno. Allegedly. Hey, man, whoever it was, I'm not saying it's him. I'm going to assume that it wasn't him. But whoever it was. Who sees a shark and thinks, man, it's about to get really nice. Yo, shark. The things I could do. The things I want to do. Dead fish. Hey, listen, we all do really weird things away from work. Things that we don't want other people to know about. I'm not about to hit up my XR4TI crew and grill them about what they did this weekend. And I don't want them asking me what I did this weekend. I mean, if bumping uglies with marine life is your thing, I don't want to know about it. As long as it doesn't affect their work, I really don't care. As long as they don't break any laws, I really don't care. What they do in their time is their own business. All I know is the SEC is brutal. And it really doesn't matter whether or not it was Jim McElwain. Because when the Gators hit the road this fall, there's going to be a lot of Tigers and Bulldogs and volunteers dressed as sharks with signs that say, "Why didn't you call me back? You free after the game, Jimmy?" Just leave this guy alone. He told us it's not him. And if he says it's not him, shouldn't that be good enough? Never mind that it looks exactly like him. I don't know. He said it's not him. That's good enough for me. It should be good enough for you. We are joined by Preds head coach, Peter LaViolette. Peter, it is so good to have you back on the program. How are you?
Jim, how you doing, bud?
Good. Peter, how about you? How are things?
We're doing good. We got together and quick meeting today just to get going. We're waiting to see where we're heading.
All right, so you beat St. Louis, of course, on Sunday, 3-1. You wrap up that series. You met with your guys quickly today. But as you advance to the conference finals, what were the kinds of emotions that you were feeling when you had that empty netter to go ahead 3-1 with 1 minute to go, and you knew at that point, essentially, we're going to advance?
Well, you're waiting for that goal. We've had a couple opportunities throughout the first few rounds to bury an empty netter and just push things further off and make it more difficult. And you see some of the empty net leads that have gotten away, I think twice in the last maybe 10 days, a two-goal lead and a three-goal lead. And, you're looking to seal it. You don't want to give that opportunity. So while empty netters, I think, sometimes are taken for granted through the regular season, when you can get one in a situation like that where it's not only game-ending but series-ending, that it's more than just an empty net goal. There's a lot of emotion on the bench and in the stands with the fans, and it just felt good to. You know, there was about a minute left at that point, a little less than a minute maybe, and it just felt good to get that and get that two-goal lead.
No doubt, and that's the way you finish a game. Now, in terms of the way the game started, Peter, you knew the Blues were going to come out. You knew they'd battle because their season was on the line. They scored just over 2 minutes into the first period.
Yeah.
It could have turned into a lot of momentum, but they never scored again. So what did you make of the way your team responded to the way St. Louis came out?
Well, I thought Pekka played really well in the first period, and that was important. And you're absolutely right. At that point, they scored early. It was kind of a funny goal. It was 3 feet wide of the net on the short side. It ends up hitting one of their players and off the post and just trickles over the goal line. But the game, it just had a bad visual to it and a bad feel. It was in our building, and we wanted to come out and rip the door off the hinges to get going, and we sputtered a little bit, and they threw shots on net. They weren't necessarily scoring chances. We had a couple power plays early on. I don't think that we were real crisp. We had scored some big power play goals in the series prior to that, and just a couple power plays that didn't add up. The 5-on-5 play wasn't real sharp. The shots were 2-1 in their favor, so it visually just didn't give a good feel. And I think just fixing it, we talked about a few things that we could do better between the first and second period, but I think Pekka just holding down the fort there for us until we get our feet under us. I thought after that, from the second period on, we were really, really strong.
Nashville head coach Peter Laviolette joining us. You mentioned Pekka. He's now 8-2. He's got a goals against of just 1.37 in the postseason.
Yeah.
So what do you make of the way he's played, and then how much confidence does it give everybody else in the room when you know he's locked in the way he is right now?
Well, you're absolutely right on both accounts. One, he's dialed in. He's playing excellent. He had a really good year. You know, if we were being honest about the way we played, I think at times we should have and could have done a better job in front of him through the course of the regular season. But down the stretch, we were playing pretty good hockey the last month and a half to 2 months. And even the games that we were losing, they might have been low-scoring events where we just didn't get enough run support for him to win a hockey game. And I think he was playing well down the stretch. He's continued that in the playoffs. He's been our best player. I think our guys have done a really good job in front of him of trying to eliminate some of the stuff that can cause havoc for goalies, just making it a little bit simpler for him. But let's be honest, and you watch any of these games going on right now, right? There has to be big saves that are being made, and he's made them for us, and that's why we're moving on.
You know, you mentioned the guys in front of him, Peter. I'm really struck by this. Your defensemen have scored or assisted on 16 of the last 18 goals that the team has scored. I had P.K. Subban on the show last week, and we were talking about the attitude and the approach of the defensemen when it comes to jumping into the play and when it comes to offense. So how much pride do you take in the fact that you've got so many guys on that team who want to be 200-foot players and not just focused on one aspect of their game?
You know, if you just think about the way the game's being played, I know everybody wants to do that. They say, yeah, we want to get our defensemen involved. We want to activate them. But the way the game's played now, if off the rush, if your defenseman's not thinking about jumping, then it's either going to be 3-on-3, 3-on-4, definitely in the offensive zone. If your defensemen aren't being active on the points, if they're not trying to figure out how they can figure into the offense, then there's five guys in front of them against your three forwards, and it just becomes more difficult the way teams play defenses right now. You really need to just have the defenseman thinking about how they can create. It's less about a position now and more about what kind of a motion can you put in play to get your team moving and create offense. So, I mean, we're lucky here because I feel like we've got six defensemen that are in the lineup right now that can all skate, they can all move the puck. I don't think that Matt Irwin and Yannick Weber have gotten enough credit for the way they've played the game. They've been really strong and really good in any situation that we've asked of them, but the top four certainly are getting talked about, and they're 200-foot players. They skate well, they move the puck well, they defend well. So not only can we, our defensemen able to create, they're playing really good defense as well.
All right, so you're not there yet, but there's something amazing going on in Smashville right now. In fact, when Subban was on the show last week, he talked about how much he loves playing in Nashville and in front of Predator fans. You're undefeated at home in the playoffs. Blues goalie Jake Allen was talking about what a tough building it is to play in. For people who have never been to a Preds game in Nashville, how would you describe the atmosphere in that arena during a game and how tough it is for opposing teams?
It's difficult for me. Have you been, Jim?
I have not been to that arena, no.
You have to take in a game. It would be difficult for me to try to describe it. It's I guess it's the volume, it's the loudness that comes through from the fans. It's the sea of gold that's out there. It's got the chance to it, almost like a European soccer match. It has great energy. They do a great job away from the game itself. Our game has been good, and I think that helps. But the game away from the game that they put on in arena is really good. And the fans are there. Like when we do the right things, they let us know when we're off a bit, maybe like we were in the first period, they pick us up. And it's just it's a crazy, crazy special place. And I said it last time, if you need to know what it's about, like if you want to see something that's pretty cool, you need to come to a game. Like that's the best way to experience, and you'll walk out with your own opinions. But it's just a real neat environment that they created here.
Let's go to Detroit. Josh in the D. Josh, you're on. What's up?
Romy, what's going on?
What's up, Josh?
Not much. Hey, just to let you know, the Caps are doing something that only 28 teams have done in the history of NHL since 1942, and we'll see on Game 7. Hey, a topic I wanted to bring up, Jimmy, is what's with the QBs going to the broadcasting booth? I mean, I can understand Romo. Yeah, the guy's banged up. He's kind of been hurt lately. But Jay Cutler? What is that, Jimmy? What is that? I mean, the guy, like, said two words in his whole career. He moons us on Instagram, and then he's going to go to the broadcast booth? I mean, really? That's pretty lame. You know, and speaking of lame, Jimmy, you know, Dan in Denver gave a call last week, which, I mean, he threw up a prayer shot, and, I mean, it bounced off the rim, Jimmy. And check that. He threw up a prayer shot, his golden ticket. It bounced off the rim. I scooped it up, Jimmy. I cashed in at the ATM. And then I bought Mike in Little Rock a real Raider hat since he's repping one from a yard sale. And since I was speaking of Mike in Little Rock, you talk about fifth grade humor on some of my prior calls and leave it to Twitter. Mike, why don't you get with John in Little Rock and maybe you guys could come back on and maybe be a parody duet together. And, oh, hey, Tyler in Edmonton. You know what? Game 7's Wednesday. Your one-hit wonder call got you the golden ticket. Where are you at? Living under the dirt? I'm out. Milk hot dog.
That's not a good call. No. You don't like
see what
that
I did there?
I don't like that call.
Not I let him get to call. The very, very, very end, although I could have run him 5 seconds in, but I wanted to hear the entirety of the call. I wanted to get as much as I possibly could. Bam, just like that, we're done. Thank you very much for listening. I appreciate you. Hit subscribe. Tell a friend. Trust the podcast. Check back tomorrow for more Daily Jungle. We will see you then. We're out.
What is that, Jimmy? What is that?